Hey guys, what is up? Welcome to episode number 15 of Being Famous Podcast. I am your host. My name is Cliff. As always, I hope everyone around the world is doing well and staying safe. Before we get to episode number 15, guys, there's something I want to mention and something that I've been working on for the past couple of months, and here it is. This podcast is now set up to take your donations. Guys, there is zero monetary gain from this podcast for me. I make $0. In fact, it actually cost me money to produce the episodes you hear. From my time, equipment, website hosting, podcast hosting, email account, web domain, and other various expenses. So with that being said, if you enjoy the podcast and would like to show your support, you can now do so through a PayPal donation. There's two ways to donate. You can donate $100 and score some very fly dope Being Famous Podcast swag, or you can simply donate any dollar amount you desire. Pretty simple and pretty easy. So if you don't care about the swag, if you don't want to donate $100, you also have the option to donate any dollar amount that you desire. $5, $25, $60, $12, whatever it may be, you also have that option. For more information, to see merchandise, and to donate, visit my webpage at beingfamouspodcast.com. Go to the donate/merchandise tab and you're good to go. All the information is right there. And guys, any donation that I receive is greatly, greatly, greatly appreciated. So thank you. Now, let's get on to episode number 15. Man, I am fired up to talk to this guy. I have always been a fan of late 80s to mid 90s R&B. That time frame was a special time in R&B music. Some have even called it the greatest time in the history of R&B. With the rise of New Jack Swing and the explosion of groups and artists that came onto the scene at that time. From H-Town, Silk, UNV, Intro, Tevin Campbell, Color Me Bad, All For One, To The Extreme, Low Key, Jodeci, Men At Large, Portrait, High Five, Lorenzo, Soul For Real, Mint Condition, Trey Lorenz, and of course, Boyz II Men. And within that group, guys, that I just mentioned, I'm probably even missing a few. And that's just the male side of it. There was also a female side to that as well, with Jade, SWV, 702, TLC, and many others. My guest today was right in the heart of it all. With all those groups I mentioned, you can't forget about the guys from Howard University, with songs like If I Ever Fall In Love, Comforter, Baby I'm Yours, Together Forever, and many more. Let's welcome to the podcast double platinum artist and founding member of the group, Shy. His name is Garfield Bright. Garfield, what up, man? Thanks for taking time out of your day to come on the show.
Hey, Cliff, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure for me to be here, man. And I'm excited. I'm looking forward to building with you. Let's get it in.
Yeah, man, let's build. I like it. Garfield, we have a lot to talk about, man. Let's start at the very beginning. Where are you from?
All right, well, I was born in Harry Hospital in Nashville, Tennessee, right? Literally born in Tennessee. And my parents moved to Knoxville when I was born. And I stayed there till I was about six, and they moved to Montgomery. And they worked at Alabama State University. And my first through third grade years were literally spent on that campus because they had an early childhood program. And that's my first through third grade school was the programs, you know, early childhood education. They had a school where students would come from the college to look in. And, you know, we were kind of like research bait. And but all the professors' children and stuff went to the school, so it was a really outstanding school. And then I moved to Atlanta for a brief period around the time when Wayne Williams and all that Atlanta killings were happening. My dad got a job with the National Education Association and moved to Atlanta. I went with him, and ultimately he moved to Boston, and I wound up doing my coming of age years in Boston, like summer of eighth grade all the way through college. I would come home to Boston, Massachusetts, specifically Brockton, Massachusetts. And, you know, that was my formative years, my real coming of age years, where I had my little breakdancing moments and played basketball, made my first basketball squads for the high school, all that kind of stuff. And then from there, I launched and went to Howard. And, you know, that's where I met Shy. That's where I met Darnell, was my roommate, who's my best friend to this day. And he was, we met in our dorms, 17 years old. And his dad, Darnell, went to Eastside High School, which was the school for Joe Clark and stuff like that, if you've seen the movie Lean on Me. And his dad was actually a social worker there and the manager at the same time of the group called Riff, who, if you watch the movie, they were singing Fair Eastside in the bathroom. That was Darnell's dad's group management-wise. And so we always grew up checking those brothers out, singing their songs to the girls in the adjacent dorm at Howard, not realizing that we would one day get a record deal ourselves. And we parted ways, Darnell and myself. Like, he ended up pledging a fraternity. We just moved from the dorm that we were in as roommates. And then I got into other things. And ultimately, we came back together. Now, and I got married and all that during the time at Howard. And when we came back together, he was in a group this time. He was in a group called Beta, because the Beta chapter of his fraternity, Alpha Phi Alpha, was at Howard University. And him and Carl Martin, who's actually penned If I Ever, they were like a two-man entity. You know what I mean?
Yeah, gotcha. And there you go, man. You just you mentioned Riff. I mentioned a bunch of artists at the beginning of this podcast, and that is one group that I forgot. Riff had a pretty big song back in the day with My Heart Is Failing Me. You also mentioned Garfield Darnell. That would be Darnell Van Rensselaer and Carl Martin and Mark Gay and yourself made up Shy. So I kind of wanted to set that up for the listeners. Garfield, tell me about your story about, because I've heard it on other podcasts and I've heard you tell it before, and I think it's pretty funny, man. Tell me about your story as to how you decided on attending Howard University.
My dad, like I said, worked for the National Education Association, and his headquarters were in Washington, D.C. And my junior year at when I was in Brockton High, it was my spring break. It happened to coincide with him going to this meeting in D.C. And he was like, hey, man, you want to roll with me to this meeting? You know, roll me with me to D.C. because I got to go to this meeting. I'm like, yeah. So we fly to D.C. together. Me and my pops take a little trip. And while he's in the meeting, which is not far from Howard's campus, he's like, hey, man, you know, I'm going to drop you off at Howard, man. You can walk around and see the campus and see how it looks. And then when I finish the meeting, you get to walk back and meet me, or I'll just come pick you up. I was like, oh, all right, you know, bad, cool. So it's a Friday, I remember, and it was like 11:30-ish, something like that. He drops me off. I walk around. I find a fine arts building. I sit down on the steps just looking at the beauty of the campus. You can see the tradition and the old, you know, the oldness of it. And you're like, wow, you know, so I'm looking at it, and it's this big bell tower, like right across from me on top of this library called Moreland Spingarn, and you can hear it. At 12 o'clock, that thing goes doom, 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 you know, that whole thing. And these doors from all the classrooms all over the campus just slam open, and all these people just rush out. And while I'm just sitting there in front of fine arts, it was nobody on campus at that point until those doors open, and all these just beautiful girls come out of just every crevice that you can imagine, just each one more beautiful than the next. Like, oh my God, is this real? You know what I mean? All in one place.
Garfield, man, it was game over.
It was game over. I didn't even apply to another school. It was like, I only applied to Howard. Like, if I didn't get accepted into Howard, I was gonna have to sit out a year. And I had basketball scholarship offers and stuff like that. I was going to Howard, man. And luckily my SATs were good enough. They accepted me and I got into HU. And, you know, the rest became history. Like I said, my first day I met Darnell and everything. And that was funny how we met.
Yeah, man. And we'll get to that in just a minute.
Yeah.
But Garfield, seriously, man, how much did the girl factor really determine your decision on going to Howard?
Well, it was like I was always a conscious type of brother growing up. Like in high school, I was one of the creators of the African-American club that we had there. So I was always critically conscious about like my heritage and my ethnicity, and you know, Black people having better working knowledge of their history than what the school provided. So I knew Howard as a legacy school in that way. I knew it was the Mecca of Black schools. I grew up on Alabama State University's campus, which is a HBCU. So I knew about the HBCU situation and that I was definitely trying to go to an HBCU. But Howard was seen as the Mecca. And so that when I actually got to visit the campus, that the ambiance and the girls definitely took it over the top. But I was already intrigued by just Howard's stature as an HBCU. It was like the dopest one. It was the one that was, you know, people get recruited from to work in corporate America. Like, people come to Howard to get the brightest minds of the Black intelligentsia, WBD boys. Like, I knew about all the legacy people there. But like I said, that girl factor as a 17, 16-year-old, that just put it way over the top, man. Like, so. But so it was like an equal thing. It wasn't like it was only, because it was pretty girls everywhere. But the Howard women, I knew they were good, high caliber, quality women. And they were just that beautiful. And they were high quality types coming from backgrounds where, you know, it was just they were expected to be somebody. by themselves and their family. So I knew what I was looking at. Like, oh my God, these are like, you don't get no better than this, right? You know what I mean? So yeah, that did it.
That's awesome, man. I hear you.
Yeah.
So Garfield, you get to Howard. What happens?
Get to Howard, 17 years old. I check into my first dorm, and because it was so many freshmen that year, I didn't have the freshman dorm on campus. They couldn't accommodate freshmen, so there was spillover into these like actual upperclassmen dorms that were downtown DC that shuttle buses had to go to. So they reserved about 4 floors out of the 10 floors for freshmen. So we had a real nice apartment too, pretty much, and it was 3 people there. So Darnell was the first roommate I had, who's in Shy, the guy who hits the high note. And I walk in, he's not there, but he has the back room. It's like a back room that's secluded. And then everybody else is like a community space, like 2 other guys. We got to live in the living room. So I thought I got there first, but Darnell beat me. And I laid my trunk there. Heck, my stepmom gave me a plaid trunk that said Garfield Roosevelt Bright Jr. So I knew Darnell was going to think I was a nerd if I wasn't there when he walked in. He played in a marching band. So he was doing 2 days. So he wasn't there. But when I finally came back, he was laying at the foot, his head was at the foot of the bed. And I had these 2 females that I had just met on the elevator. And I didn't have any idea who they were. They were just nice females who had made a comment about my shoes. So I was like, let me go see if my roommate, they invited me to go to Pizzeria Uno. I was like, well, let me go check and see if my roommate wants to go. I got to meet my new roommate. So they walked down there with me. I walk in with them with my arms around both of them. And I was like, yo, Darnell, I'm your new roommate. Yo, you know, and I was like, yo, I'm your roommate. What's your name? He was like, yo, I'm Darnell. And he looked up at me, and I was like, yo, you trying to go to Pizzeria Uno, man, with us and all that? And he's like, nah, man, I'm tired for these 2 days. So when I get back later and finally really chop it up with him, he's like, yo, do you realize who you were just with? And I was like, nah. He was like, the girl on your right arm was the captain of the cheerleading team, and the girl on your left arm was the captain of the dancers that mark dance in front of the band, do all the provocative dance. He said, that's who you were just chilling with. I was like, what? And that's how our history of Howard kicked off me and D and stuff like that.
That's great, man. So Garfield, within just a matter of hours of being on campus, man, your game is already in full effect.
Yeah, it was fun. It was, Howard was just like, but these were like, they were really, like I saw them as like, they were upperclassmen. So they were like, in my mind, they were just, you know, they couldn't possibly be looking at me as like any kind of interest because they were like upperclassmen. That's kind of how we saw it, that divide. But they made this comment about my shoes on the elevator. They were like, look, you can tell a lot about a person by the shoes that he wears. And they were giving me a compliment. And so we were chopping it up. By the time we got to my floor, they had invited me for pizza. And I was like, well, let me go check on my roommate. And, you know, I thought they was taking me in as like a little brother type. But it still doesn't, you know, negate the fact that these were like the probably like 2 of the most sought after type of girls on college campus that I happened to fall into. And, you know, and so, yeah, they were beautiful and all that. But, yeah, I don't know. It was always that type of situation, man. I just always lucked up and fell into situations like that.
That's awesome, man. So did you end up going to Pizzeria Uno with them?
I went with them, but Darnell was too tired. He didn't want to go. Plus, Darnell's girlfriend at the time was one of those dancers in front of the band. So that girl that was the captain of the dancers, Darnell knew who they were because his girl was there. He would have got in trouble. Like, he would have been like, she'd have been like, what are you doing with, you know? So we, you know.
That's funny, man.
He knew he was being strategic. That's when I came back, that's why he let me know who I was dealing with and why he didn't really go.
Okay, gotcha. So his girlfriend at the time was also at Howard.
Yeah, she was at Howard. She's one of those dancers. He had The band members come a little bit earlier than the rest of the freshmen because the band has to kind of practice before everybody gets to school. They come a little earlier. That's how he got that back room before me. And so he knew all the politics and the lay of the land and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. Garfield, did you know? I know you didn't know Darnell prior to attending Howard, but had you spoken to him over the telephone before actually meeting him?
No, I had no idea who my roommates were going to be. Like, I literally got my key to my room and was hoping and praying that I was the first one there so I can get this back room that kind of had its own self-contained bathroom and all that. And, you know, it was 3 roommates to a room, and one person lucked up and got that room. So I got there, but he was already there. I mean, his stuff was already there, even though he was on campus.
Yeah, man, that self-contained bathroom is pretty important in dorm life. Garfield, let me ask you this. Life is funny sometimes, man. You can meet somebody, and when you meet that person, you have things in common, you're vibing with one another. Did you know from day one that you and Darnell were just going to click and we're going to be boys?
Day one. That was my guy. Like, we had all these common interests. He was from Jersey. I was coming from, you know, Boston. It was like urban, two urban type areas. We were highly influenced by hip hop, basketball, music. We had all these similar interests. Darnell used to steal my poems and read to his girlfriend as if he did it. So we were all into the same things. We used to go next door to the adjacent female dorm and sing. So we were always, you know, it was always a dynamic. Every weekend we would go places together. We would walk all downtown DC together and stuff like that, bonding, playing basketball against the neighborhood guys. And, you know, coming up through those types of situations, sometimes, you know, forges an even closer relationship. Like, a lot of the times in DC during the crack era, police would come and break up our basketball games because there'd be somebody on the court maybe that was a, you know, had done a crime or something. It was crazy. And so we would all go through these weird, almost getting locked up experiences so they could check everybody to make sure, you know, we were going through these types of things together, almost getting into fights with locals and stuff together. You know, the types of things coming of age that bonds become made from. We went through a lot of that stuff, you know, with different females and so talking about, you know, intimate type of situations and trusting in each other and, you know, having each other's back and all those kinds of things. And then in our own right, standing out amongst our peers. Like, Darnell was like, just like Nick Cannon in Drumline with the drums, Darnell was that freshman who was making up the dance routines for the marching band as a freshman. He came in with this extraordinary talent. He played the trumpet, music education major. And he was just one of those guys who had the it factor in terms of the music, but he was a rebel. So, but the people above, you know, the authority figures knew he was talented. So they worked with him, but they were mad at him half the time, you know, but he was just that talented. And then me, you know, I was coming of age. I was heavy in the political scene at Howard. People started to know who I was. I ran for offices and stuff like that. And I was kind of like, my weight was coming up at the same time. So we were kind of both elevating at the same time.
That's good stuff, man. What was your major?
I was a political science major. I worked on Capitol Hill for the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Okay.
During my tenure there. And so I sat down and ate lunch sometimes with the Congressional Black Caucus. And I was kind of connected in those ways due to my mom. She worked for the Alabama Education Association and the Alabama Democratic Conference. She's a voting delegate. So she kind of used her connections to get me internships. And because, yeah, as a political science major, she wanted me to have the inside track and know these power players as I matriculated. And so that, you know, I was privy to certain environments and stuff like that. And I found out that I didn't want to do that stuff.
Yeah, man, I hear you. So, Garfield, so 2 weeks go by, 2 months go by, 3 months go by. You're on Howard's campus. Are you loving it?
I'm loving it. I'm finding that the coursework is something that I can, you know, one of my main things was, can I hang? And, you know, I was good in my high school academically, but college had this stigma attached to it to me. Like, okay, can I do this college level work? So at that point, I was finding out that I was able to, you know, I had the gray matter and the aptitude to kind of hang. I majored in chemistry first, which is, well, not my choice. My dad was like, you know, you can't make any money poli sci, man. You need to be a lawyer. You need to be a doctor. So major in chemistry. But I didn't have that kind of aptitude. Plus, it was narrow. Like, everybody getting the same answer from the same formulas in the same way with no wiggle room. Like, I'm an expressive type. So I have to be able to express myself. So I switched majors. But I realized quick that I was going to switch majors. And I was hanging in chemistry and stuff like that. In my English classes, I was writing the best papers. My other liberal arts classes, I was doing well. So I was getting acclimated. I wanted to try out for the basketball team and stuff like that. And because I didn't get recruited by Howard, they wrote me a letter. You know, they write you these interest letters, but they never came to Boston to scout me. You know, so I felt like I could hang because I've been playing summer basketball with a lot of the players and I've been holding my own. So I felt like I needed to try out. But I didn't get the memo that you have to have a drug test before you even walked on to try out. So when it was 6 a.m. for tryouts, walk-on tryouts, I didn't have this little white piece of paper. Not that I did drugs or anything. I just never got that thing. So it disqualified me from even trying out. And so my dream was quickly dashed. I saw a few people make the team that I knew I was beating all summer long. And I was like, I went the other way with it. But, I ended up being in Shy. So it was like a good deal. But, yeah, I was getting involved. I was getting my feet wet. I was joining organizations on campus and stuff like that during the first few months.
Yeah, man, you don't end up making the basketball team or you don't end up joining the basketball team, but you become a member of Shy, which I would say to me is that's a pretty good trade-off. Speaking of which, Garfield, let's get to it, man. How did Shy come to be?
Well, like I said, Darnell and Carl were part of a group called Beta, which is their fraternity, Beta chapter, was at least in Howard. So there was this big talent show coming up, big talent show. And it were five alphas in the group at this point to the talent show. At this point, my dad had claimed me on his taxes because I had gotten married, but my dad claimed me on his taxes. And so I couldn't get financial aid anymore from Howard, but I still had my housing. And so in that semester, I was just like, I couldn't go to class. It was like I had two semesters left at Howard. And I made a 4.0 for the first time, hoping to get a trustee scholarship. But that didn't work. They didn't give me a trustee scholarship. So I was literally sitting out this semester, just hanging out with Darnell when he would go to the Fine Arts Building to practice with the group for this big talent show coming up. And so two of the guys, like this talent show was notorious because it's like the Apollo, the atmosphere in there. People would get booed. Like it was like a intense, hostile environment. So right before the show, two of the guys that were the five-man group dropped out. So it left only three people left, Carl, Darnell, and Mark. And Darnell was like, yo, G, I know you know these vocals. We need four-part harmony, man. Like we can do this show. It's days away. Like I know you know these vocals. So I agreed to go ahead and like, get down with them for this talent show.
How'd you know the vocals?
Well, I've been sitting there with Darnell every day for like 7 hours a day for maybe like 2 or 3 months straight.
Gotcha.
Just hanging out because like I said, my classes, I had signed up for a temp agency to get a temp job, but they weren't forthcoming. And I still had housing, but I couldn't be in school because my dad claimed me on his taxes and they revoked my financial aid. So I was kind of in limbo and I was hanging with Darnell while he went to Fine Arts Building and practiced and rehearsed with the group that he was in. So I picked up all these vocals while I was just sitting there watching them practice all those hours a day. I kind of knew the different vocals. And they were doing cover tunes of Boys to Men songs. End of the Road, Please Don't Go Away From Me. So I learned all the bass line notes. The dude Mike in Boys to Men, I learned all his notes. And I picked it up. And so, we didn't do any shows but that one show before we got a record deal. So a lot was riding on this show. And once the show happened, everybody got booed except for us. And they asked for a kind of an encore. We went on and we didn't know what to sing for the encore. So we were like, you want to sing our practice songs? You know, let's sing If I Ever. And we sung If I Ever. And by the chorus, on the second chorus, the kind of crowd kind of was singing along with us. And we felt like we might have something special here. And so that's when, that's when we decided to try to get a record deal. That night on stage after the curtains closed, we were like, yo, y'all want to try to get a deal?
Great story. What songs did you guys sing for the talent show?
During that show, we sung Please Don't Go Away From Me by Boyz II Men. We sung and then we sung End of the Road, and I think a little bit of Motown Philly. And we did well with those. It was like a medley. And then they loved it, and so they asked us to sing another song, and we sung If I Ever. And that hit even harder than the other songs, and it was our original tune. So that inspired us to try to see if the crowd that boos people was giving us support and singing our song by the second chorus and they hadn't known it was an original, maybe we have something that was special enough to go get a record deal. So
right then and there, you guys pretty much decided, hey, you know, let's go try to get a deal and see what happens.
Yeah, right there on the stage, all four of us, as the curtains closed, we literally were standing there looking at each other, amazed at what had just happened. And, decided to try to go get it. In our naivety, we thought because we had a great song, it should happen. Jodeci had just got signed to a deal and they just showed up cold turkey in New York's doorsteps and their talent was such that they got signed immediately. So we felt like, well, shoot, we could do that.
For sure. So what was the mood like amongst you guys, Garfield? I mean, you guys go perform at this talent show. Everybody gets booed except you guys. You're now talking about getting a record deal. I can imagine you guys are pretty much on cloud nine. What was the mood at that point in time amongst the group?
It was like because we were coming, I can speak for myself personally, because I was so in that mindset of, I just don't want to get booed and anything, if I got that accomplished, that was the victory I needed. It was such a nervous kind of tension to just making sure that that didn't happen. I didn't have that mode of thinking at the time to be elated, like to be just totally comfortable in that space of like, yes, it was more like, yes, we didn't get booed, you know?
Sure.
But still recognizing in that moment that, wait a minute, hold up, they didn't boo us, but they actually loved our song too. Yo. So it was like more of a quizzical, curious, like, well, where can this go type of thing, more than like an elated feeling. It was more like a curiosity and like, maybe we can flip this, you know, like a opportunistic kind of feel to the whole thing.
Gotcha. Yeah. So how does the deal come to be?
Well, long story short, we didn't get a record deal in New York when we went up there to try to get a deal. None of the labels kind of like really like cared. Like, you know, they dissed us really. They were on the phone. Some of them smoking cigarettes on the phone while we were singing If I Ever a cappella and all that.
But let me interrupt you real quick. So does everybody go to New York, the whole group?
Yeah, all of us, including Carl's brother, Derek, who was our manager at the time, Derek Martin. And we go up to New York, and he set up a bevy of like meetings with different labels. The Avenue of Americas in New York used to have all the labels on it. Atlantic, you know, all the different ones. MCA, all of them. So we had meetings set up with each. We go to perform or sing a little bit of If I Ever. Some of them actually listened and liked the song, but because it was a cappella at the time, they weren't sure if program directors were going to play it, so they kind of backed away from it. But when we came back to D.C., there was a softball game with a local radio station called WPGC, and they played with the community. And so Carl, Darnell, and Mark went there. So I don't know what the heck I was doing, but they went over there and handed them a demo tape. And the guy, Paco Lopez, who was one of the main DJs there, played it for the crew, his radio station peers, and they like really liked it. And at the same time, the people, they were coming out with a home jams version of Thing Happening Mechanism on their radio station for local talent. And so they wanted to put it on that, which they did. And the phone calls start blowing up. And we started getting a lot of traction for that particular song. And it was beginning to chart before we even had a record deal. And so Carl had kind of like hooked in with MCA, who had given us some money to kind of like do a demo to try to see if we can do a music version. They kind of didn't want to give us a record deal yet, but they were, had to give us enough money to do a music version of If I Ever. And I think contingent upon how that sounded to them, if they could work it, then we would talk further. And so we recorded the music version. Darnell came up with the Isaac Hayes sample, and Mark, they were like, you know, they were like the chief kind of musicians. And If I Ever music version was born, and the label loved it, and they were ready to fly us out there to do a deal based on, you know, the fact that it was charting. So half their work was already done. And the song that we had made for the music version ended up being really, really good. So they were sold. They were like, okay, we're going to give y'all a record deal. So we flew out to Cali to sign it up. And that's when we started doing all the industry stuff, you know.
Really cool story, man. Garfield, do you remember who some of the labels were that passed on you guys?
Yeah, I remember like Atlantic, Elektra. There was a couple of more. I want to say, I don't think we went to MCA New York, but it's definitely, I definitely remember Atlantic and Elektra being two major ones that we stayed there. Because the one in Elektra is when they were on the phone smoking. And the one in Atlantic was they had this birthday girl for one of their employees. And on her cake, it was this penis. And they wanted us to sing happy birthday to her in the middle of this kind of like private kind of setting. Like, and I was embarrassed. It was just a weird situation. We sung, you know, and nobody, nothing came of it and everything. And there was another label too, but I just couldn't remember which one that was. But I remember those two specifically.
Penises on cakes, people smoking while you're singing. Yeah, man, sounds pretty interesting. Garfield, in a situation like that, when you guys go into the record label offices, who are you guys performing for? Is it just like the A&R people?
Yeah, A&Rs, the A&Rs, the A&Rs of the label. They took a look at us.
And their reasoning for not signing you guys was pretty much because you guys were a cappella?
Well, yeah, kind of. You know, they were like, song is hot. You know, it's just, and a lot of the times the A&Rs don't want to take on a budget, period. They just want to do remixes because it's safe. The song has been proven. So they'll do a remix to it and it'll still chart. They'll still keep their job because they won't lose too much. So looking at unique talent coming in, they don't want to take a chance a lot of times unless it's some real inside connection type of thing. So the politics of it was really, the real politic of it was the politics more so than the talent. But in our naivety, we thought we had a dope song. We supposed to be out there getting played, you know, on the radio. So
yeah, for sure. So you guys leave New York, you don't have a deal. Did that crush your spirits in any way, or did you guys still remain optimistic that you could eventually get a deal?
No, we still had like aspirations of still trying to do it. Like we felt like that was just, you know, maybe we don't have enough songs on a demo. Maybe we need a couple more songs. But in the meantime, before we could even record any more songs, they gave that tape to Paco at that softball game, and it started just growing legs. If I Ever itself became like a commodity, an item, before we had to even record any other music. And
this DJ Paco, he's playing the acapella version, right?
The acapella version, yeah.
Gotcha. So, Garfield, the version that he played, the acapella version, that version that he was playing, how much different is that version than what we hear today, you know, let's say on the radio?
Oh, no, that was because we did a demo of that. Like, we got a mix. We went to Q Studios in Virginia and recorded that acapella and actually really fully did it out. Like, even though it was acapella with no instrumentation, we got it actually mixed and mastered. So that demo was like a professional, you know, albeit an acapella situation, it was a professional demo. So that version is the version that you hear.
Okay, yeah, wow, gotcha. There's just so many layers to the story, man. I mean, this part alone we could probably talk about forever, and that's the fact that you guys aren't playing around, right? I mean, you go to Virginia,
yeah.
You get it professionally mixed, professionally mastered, so you guys are fully invested. But back to the story, Garfield. He starts to play it. You guys don't have a deal, and it gains traction, and you guys actually start to chart without a record deal.
Yeah, it was like because PGC just so happens that that radio station – back in those days, it was what you call a P1 station. P1s are before the big conglomerates, the consulting firms stepped into the game. Other radio stations in the lower secondary markets and tertiary markets will copy the playlist of what the program directors of the P1s were doing. That's how they got their program list together. So if PGC added us to their rotation, that automatically meant not only other P1s that were their sister stations throughout the country added us also, but then the secondary and tertiary markets who copied those playlists also played the song because they were copying PGC's playlist for what was hot and what was happening. So by default, when we got added to PGC, we were getting radio airplay around the nation. And that's one of the criterion by which, before videos came into the fray, that you had chart position. So we were really on the charts without having a record deal yet. And that's one of the points that the record label kind of saw as like, whoa, they're charting and we ain't even pushing them yet. We didn't even put any money behind them. They're already kind of charting. So once we push them, you know, with our apparatus, with our machine, we could really take this record somewhere else, you know, so.
Yeah, that's really cool, man. And, you know, I mean, to stop and think about it and put it in perspective, I mean, you guys are just a couple of guys who are students at Howard and, you know, all of a sudden you have this song that's gaining traction and it's starting to track and it's getting played across the country, man. I mean, it's just crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I mean, what were you guys thinking at that point in time, Garfield? I mean, what was that? I don't know, man. What was that feeling like?
It was one of those things. It was happening. It was so quick. And it was like the moment was you were in the moment and it was progressing almost with or without you in terms of like, if you were cognizant enough to be rooted in it and knowing what was happening, it was still happening regardless how you saw it. And so you were catching glimpses of the reality of it, like, dang, is this really happening? But then you look at your pocket and, you know, you barely can afford some food. So you kind of like reality is back in your face. But then you're looking at it like, dang, but our song is like, you know. And so we got a few lawyers, OZ Wells, I think, Oswald Thaddeus, OT. And to broker the deal. That's how we got our demo money to do the music version. And once we got the music version money, then we knew it was kind of like when you do fishing, you know, you might land a fish and you're fighting with it. And the main thing you're thinking is you're hoping that it'll just take your bait and jump off the hook. Like, but you in the game though, you got traction. So that's kind of how we were with MCA. It was all riding on whether or not that music version to If I Ever was going to be something that they could believe in.
Yeah, and we'll get to that in just a minute. But Garfield, as you guys are sitting on Howard's campus and this song is starting to chart, are you guys able to, you know, I guess track that or see the progression of it? Oh, it's getting this many spins in LA. It's getting this many spins in Atlanta. It's getting this many spins down in Florida. Are you guys able to track the progression of that song?
Not in real time. You know, you kind of got to wait on like the Billboard to come out to see where you are you know. But you know how record execs, they can kind of like each week there's a report so they can see exactly. We didn't have that. We weren't privy to that information, but we could see that it was on the charts. It was getting charted. And then certain, like Howard University Radio, certain people and the personnel would let us know, yo, y'all, you know, y'all song is bubbling under this week. And, different little things like that let us know that we were kind of like in the game, in the ballpark as something to watch. So we knew that we had that going for us and everything. But still those fears that would ultimately, like we knew it, that could preclude us was stuff like, it's an a cappella song. It was different than Boyz II Men's a cappella with the Coolie High Harmony, because Coolie High Harmony was DC Cameron from a movie that was already well established. And it was okay to do an a cappella with that because it was already familiar. But an original song by some college kids that was a cappella, people might feel like they're taking a chance to put that in the program director to put that into the rotation. So we knew we were still kind of up against that. So like I said, it came back down to this music version that we were about to make. If we could do justice to that song without losing too much character and making it something that people could go behind, the label can put money behind and get played.
Okay, so you guys end up getting signed to Gasoline Alley, which is a part of MCA. How did that all come to be?
Well, Carl, like once again, like Carl was ahead of us in terms of business savvy. Like he really wanted to be in the industry. So he had done all his research and homework. He knew way more about the industry than the rest of us at the time as a college student. And once again, he wrote that song. So even when he and Darnell was a two-man group, he had aspirations of really being in the industry. Darnell was a musician, so he was kind of helping him do the music part of it, while Carl was an excellent writer. So during this part, he was a personality type that was reaching out to different labels. He could talk to people and get, you know, he had a talent for getting inside of people and talking to them and doing that kind of thing. So he had talked to Gasoline Alley, kind of sold them on it. Once they heard the song, they loved it. And then they kind of start feeling around and seeing that it was doing what it was doing. And they were interested enough in it that they were really willing to give us a little more money to see if we can record a real music version and stuff like that.
And okay, cool. Garfield, when you say that the label gives you a little bit more money to go put together a music version, what is a little bit more money, man? What does that, I have no idea what that is. What does that look like? Is that $500? Is that $10,000? Is that $1,200? What is that?
It's a demo deal. I think it was like $3,000, $3,500 or something like that, if I remember correctly, to go into the studio, to really have a high quality studio, to have a high quality mix engineer and a masterman, so that we can come out with a real product that they could like instantly sling and sell. And so that cost, you know, back in those days when everything was manual and there was like analog. It was a lot of analog situations. There's real 2-inch slaves and all that kind of stuff. It costs money for those engineers to be in there really cutting that tape and doing different things and all that kind of stuff. So that was about it. And then we had a little bit to pocket, you know, to live on for a little bit to eat with.
Yeah. So the deal is basically contingent upon you guys putting together a music version.
A good music version that we think is commoditable, like, you know, like something that's worth, that's holding weight, just like the acapella. Then we'll give you an album deal. So it was a demo deal. They were giving us money to do a demo, basically.
Yep. Gotcha. So obviously you guys were like, sure, we'll do it.
Hell yeah, we college students, what do we have to lose? And we thought the song was already a smash. And, you know, if anything, that was just another avenue that we could pivot to. Even if it didn't work, we knew that we were charting. So that had to mean something. So we were kind of like, you know, willing to go all out. And so we went to the studio immediately. And
where did you guys go?
We went back to Q Studio.
Okay.
We did it down in Virginia and did the music version and everything. And so...
So Garfield, when you guys do the music version, who comes up with the music? I mean, who decides how that is, what it is? I guess basically, you know, who produces it?
Yeah, we to do the music, though, Darnell came, when we got the money for the demo deal, Darnell met us at that meeting where the lawyer was basically telling us that we got the money for the demo deal. He came to that meeting with a sample from Isaac Hayes. Dum, 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 dum. It was a song from Isaac Hayes. Darnell was like, yo, we should use this as a sample in If I Ever. And so Darnell and Mark were like really, really musicians. Like they could really play. and conceptualize the music aspect. Carl was getting really, at that time, getting good with the drums, learning some keys, but his main thing actually was he had a great, great ear for writing. He was a really good writer. And so, but Mark and Darnell really built that music remix pretty much. And so we got to the studio and they put the stuff together and came, finally created the track and got it to where they wanted it. And we thought it was, and it was slightly, the melody was a little augmented from the acapella. It wasn't the same. So we had to do a few different vocal things to compensate for the fact that the music version had a little different kind of harmonic to it. And it worked, you know? And so we came together and once we learned the new version, once we got together and agreed on how it should be, then we did the parts and they work harmonically. And we just adapted it to the musical track and sung it over and it worked.
Yeah, that's good stuff, man. And I never knew that the sample was from Isaac Hayes, Garfield. I'm not a music guy, but listening to the music version, it sounds, when I say I'm not a music guy, I mean, I don't know all the intricacies behind it and how it works and all that sort of stuff. All I know about music is that I like it. But the music version sounds pretty simple, man. I mean, it doesn't sound too complicated. It's just basically a, I guess, a drum machine and a saxophone, right?
No, it's pretty simple. I can't get into the technical aspects of it because I'm not the guy who did that. Like, I know Carl has something to do with the drums, so did Darnell. But Darnell and Mark definitely did the musical parts of it, the music, the melody stuff. And the main thing was not overshadowing our harmonies, our vocals. We wanted a music version that wasn't too heavy to where the acapella aspects of what we did, which was going to be our niche, was overpowered. So we wanted to keep it kind of sparse and basic enough to let the vocals be the instrument. I do remember the philosophy behind that being the case. And so we did that. And so instead of ooh, da do 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 do, we were ooh, you know, it was like ooh, it was like longer oohs and it's more sustained, you know, and, you know, just more of an elongated kind of approach to it, more dreamy kind of. And the acapella is more shock value, a little like more stops, more percussive type of elements.
Cool. And what about the saxophone?
Yeah, Kevin Levi. So he was in the Howard University jazz ensemble, one of them. He was like probably the best jazz saxophonist at Howard, like real good. And he was cool with us, and so he came, and because Darnell was in the, you know, in the band, so he knew Kevin Levi personally and stuff. Kev agreed to come do it, and we had a little money to pay him through that budget, and he played the sax on that as well as a song called Comforter when we did our album and everything. So yeah, Kevin Levi played that solo. He ended up being in our actual band when we first went on the tour too. All of our whole band was Howard University jazz ensemble members. Raymond Angry, Kevin Levi, Gordon, Mark.
Yeah, that's really cool, man. Garfield, you mentioned Comforter. Comforter, another big song for you guys. Back in 1993, went to number 10 on the Hot 100 chart, went to number 4 on the R&B charts. Garfield, wanted to ask you about the Isaac Hayes sample. Did you guys get his permission to use that in If I Ever Fall in Love?
Oh yeah, we had to clear our samples. We couldn't come up. Yeah, for sure. Like our label, you know, Gasoline Alley was a joint venture with MCA. So they were savvy. Randy Phillips, who was the president of the label, who was came into the game being the manager of Rod Stewart during Rod Stewart's glory years and stuff like that. And he was also really close friends with Al Teller, who was the president of MCA Records. So in terms of knowledge of the industry and what needed to be done, so we wouldn't get sued. Oh, they were on top of that. They were in some subsidiary or some small, even though they were small in size, they were an actual joint venture money wise with MCA. So they had all those bases covered. Yeah.
Gotcha. So when you guys get your deal, how exactly does that go down?
We flew to MCA to finalize it and sign it in their presence and stuff like that. So we got on a plane to go sign a deal and ran in the offices of Gasoline Alley.
So was that L.A. or New York?
That was in L.A. They were in L.A.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. And how old were you at the time?
Like 20 years old, maybe 21, but that, like 20, 21. We had staggered ages. Everybody wasn't the same age. So 20 and 21.
Yeah. And do you kind of remember what you were feeling at that point in time, Garfield? I mean, you're young. The rest of the guys are young. You're flying to L.A. to sign a record deal. Definitely exciting times in all of your lives. Do you remember that emotion and what you were feeling at that time?
Yeah, vaguely. It's weird. I seem like I should remember that more than anything. But I do remember thinking to myself, like, this is the start of some new phase of my world, a new trajectory. Like, I'm excited about it. I know what I'm getting ready to go there to do. I'm hoping that nothing weird happens on the way to where it just falls through. I'm probably more scared of that than anything because it seems like almost too good to be true. But I know the song is doing what it's doing, so it's real. I'm pinching myself. And but I'm confident, but I'm cautiously confident and cautiously optimistic, like skeptically optimistic, if you could put it in words. I had that feeling. The optimistic part, I was real happy, though. But then I would check myself, like, okay, reserve some space for something that might not go according to plan in your emotion pool. Don't get too high for this.
Yeah, man, smart move on your part to hold that space. Garfield, you hear about it time and time again, man. Artists signing bad deals. Did you guys sign a bad deal?
No, actually, for a rookie deal, we kind of got a better end of the stick than most rookie deals. We had a little bit more, since we did have everything in-house and wrote our own stuff, we had a little bit more leverage. And the fact that the song, we were getting signed off a song that we wrote off the top, it was more like we had a little bit more room to kind of negotiate. Like, we had a little more power than usual, but it wasn't terrible. There were other groups that got way worse deals than we got and stuff like that. You know, we ended up renegotiating, though, of course, terms after the second album. After the first album, to get to the second album, we renegotiated to get a little bit better terms. But our deal it wasn't all just excellent either. It was a rookie deal. And any contract is skewed power dynamic wise. Because you know, you're dealing with somebody who owns the chips and you're just trying to negotiate and navigate and get pieces of it to get, you know, to get a better situation. But given that being the case, we had an okay situation. It wasn't terrible. It wasn't the best, it wasn't like a Prince deal or something like Michael Jackson, you know, we didn't own our masters, you know, by today's standards, it's a shitty deal because, you know, today people like 21 Savage, you know, they own their own masters when they sign. They know their leverage and their power, and they have the digital situations going on where they can bolster that leverage from the get. And, you know, we didn't have that. But considering the time that we were in, we had a pretty moderate rookie deal.
Okay. All right. So, Garfield, take me through the experience of actually signing the deal. So you guys get on a plane, you fly to LA, you go to Gasoline Alley. When you get to Gasoline Alley's offices, what is that like, man? Are they welcoming? Do they roll out the red carpet for you guys? Or is it pretty much like, here's the papers, guys. Here's where you sign. And that was pretty much it. What was that like?
It was weird. It was Hollywood because it was the offices were like right smack dab, like around the corner from Rodeo Drive down in Beverly Hills, you know. And so we go in and Randy is there and there's an it's a co-owner. It's Randy Phillips and oh my God, I can't remember the other guy's name. He was a character. I can't remember his name, but it was a real like flamboyant type of guy, the other guy, real rich. And I'm gonna remember his name in a minute. But it was very welcoming. They had love for us. We were like going to be their biggest act. And we felt the love. We felt like it was good vibes. It was a good situation we were coming into. We knew that they were kind of counting on us to do something big. And it felt that way. But at the same time, I was just cautious because it was just a new scene. I didn't trust everybody just off the face of it. So I was kind of a little, you know, but I was happy and, you know, nice and everything. I was still a little reticent. But.
Yeah, man. And, you know, rightfully so, you are dealing with a record label. Garfield, let me ask you this, man. You signed the deal, then what?
We signed our deal. Wow, we signed our deal. And it's like, you know, we get our little advances and everybody's got a little comfortable amount of pocket change now coming from a Howard University, from a campus life. We can barely afford to go into a restaurant and get a decent meal. And now we got enough to do some stuff with, buy some food, keep our fridges stocked, go get some clothes. But we get our deal, but business is first. We deal with the accountant. We go to our accountant, Lester Nispel, and go to these different meetings. And then we also had to do the album. They really wanted us to do a whole album in 2 weeks. because they wanted to capitalize off of the album sales as opposed to just the single. The cash cow in their mind was If I Ever. So immediately they wanted to capitalize off selling that as a part of an album for $20 as opposed to a single for $9.99. So they tried to put us with different producers because we did have a couple of other songs that the A&R was like, hey, this is pretty decent. Like a couple of songs that we did a cappella, like Comforter and Baby I'm Yours, they saw those as singles. So early on, identified those as, okay, they have some singles on here. So they wanted other producers to kind of like put music to these a cappella pieces. But it wasn't working out. David Way, who had done the Kissing Game for High Five, was trying to do a track to Baby I'm Yours. And it was way too pop and it was way too soft. And we rebelled. So time was starting to waste. They were like, okay, well, just you guys do it. And, you know, give us what you got. You know what I mean? So we had the freedom by default to then go and knock our own stuff out for like, you know, for 2 weeks, be in the lab and finish the, really put music to the stuff we kind of had a cappella and maybe add a couple of new songs. And that's what we did. But If I Ever was definitely going to be the chess piece that they played first.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy, man. So you guys recorded the entire album, If I Ever Fall in Love, in 2 weeks?
Yeah, 2 weeks. We had studio time booked from noon to midnight, straight for 2 weeks, where we went in, did vocals, put music to stuff, track stuff. It was just a not never, like 2 weeks straight of noon to midnight, noon to midnight, noon to midnight, noon to midnight.
Wow, that's pretty crazy and pretty fast. Where did you guys record that album?
We did stuff all over the place. We did Larrabee West, Larrabee North. We did Can-Am. We did some stuff in the Eurythmics. Annie Lennox had this dope studio in her backyard. We recorded some stuff there, I think. Or maybe that was like Place We Belong. But yeah, we did all the Larrabees. We did all the Can-Ams. And we did pre-production when we came home at our crib. We did at our little apartment at the Oakwood. We were doing pre-production stuff to cut the time. So when we did get to the studio, we had some stuff already ready to be tracked. And so it was just like a continuous cycle.
Yeah, that's crazy, man. It's like a whirlwind. Garfield, was that recorded in L.A.? And you say Larrabee. What is Larrabee?
All L.A. Larrabee. The Larrabee Studios are these known studios out there that are very, like, all the artists, all the big-name artists from Michael Jackson to whomever record at Larrabee. And so they have two locations out there, Larrabee West and Larrabee East, I guess. And then Can-Am Studio was in the Valley. We booked some time there when Larrabee wasn't available. And so we were just back and forth between maybe two or three studios, nonstop.
Yeah, gotcha. So Garfield, when you guys signed the deal, you guys go back to Howard?
Or do you stay
right there in L.A.?
We were home, yeah. We had moved. We were uprooting. When we signed the deal, we were about to make this album and then go straight to promotional tour mode and all that kind of stuff. So we knew that was the beginning of a new... And we were living in dormitories, so we didn't have any domicile. Like, you know, we didn't have anything holding us or anchoring us. We was college students. We were transients. we were able to, we were mobile. Yeah.
Yep. Cool. So Garfield, you guys record the album in 2 weeks. If you recorded the album in 2 weeks, I'm assuming the large majority of it was already written. Is that correct?
Yeah. Most of it was written. We were writing a couple of maybe three or four new songs were written there. But most of the stuff was stuff that we were doing a cappella at Shy. Like, we just had songs that we had done, you know, like Comforter and Baby I'm Yours. Mark had a song called Together Forever. We wrote a new song called Sexual. And I think I Don't Want to Play No Games, Waiting for the Day was something that we kind of put together while we were there. So it was constant writing, pre-production, and then retrofitting tracks to go over songs that were already done at Howard. So it was like a lot going on at all times, all 24 hours of the day for 2 weeks.
Yeah, it's a lot going on, man. And I'm assuming at this point in time, Garfield, that the single, If I Ever Fall in Love, is still continuing to climb the charts.
Yeah, it was the label had no problem getting it added to stations, the black stations and the pop stations, where it was taking off. So it was making their job easier and it was charting. So Randy Phillips, the president of the label, was able to use his influence to really get it overseas in a bigger market, or in a market overseas, to more expansive. He was good with doing that. He had ties with MTV Europe and I think it was RCA was kind of like the parent company of a lot of this stuff He knew the guy directly. Like, he was a big power broker, Randy Phillips. So he was able to get us in spaces. We were doing like the equivalent to the Grammys over in Europe, the top of the pops over in Europe. Like, our brand, we were branding ourselves heavy in Europe before we even did the United States. So chart-wise, it was an international song before it was even domestically. Like, he was just catching legs domestically, and it was already international because of the way that they did it. And so we had to kind of fight to get them to honor our black radio stations coming out of Howard. We were kind of getting alienated from that. And so we had to really fight them to make them let us do promotional stuff with the black radio. Because our competition, like Silk and Jodeci, they were doing interviews with the black stations and we weren't. So they were like, the stations were looking at us like we were bougie or something. Like, but we didn't have control over that. We had no idea about the game. So once we found out, we started making a vigilant effort to make sure we did those. And that's when we got the balance. And that's why they released Comforter second instead of Baby I'm Yours second.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that in just a second, Garfield, because I know there's some drama around which single was going to be released next, either Comforter or Baby I'm Yours. We will talk about that in just a minute. But you mentioned it, man. I wrote it down. I'm finally circling back around to it because I want to ask you the whole Annie Lennox thing, man. That's cool. Were you guys able to meet her?
Nah, the studio, we did The Place Where You Belong, which was on the Beverly Hills Cop 3 soundtrack there. And that was by far out of all the studios that we performed in. Recorded. That was my favorite. That was the dopest studio. The backyard was like walking through Shangri-La just to get to the thing. And it was kind of like situated like this log cabin kind of esque feel in a cut. But once you went in, it was real comfortable. It was a combination of real cozy, comfortable, but real technologically advanced, chic. And the sound was incredible. And the vibe was just insane, man. It had the water, it had a lot of water things with the bonsai tree. It was just dope aesthetics in there. You know, Annie Lennox, you know what I mean? You can imagine, you know, if you were seeing her and her artsiness, it was all of that was, the vibe was there like that. It was an artist studio with this. I love that place, man.
Yeah, man, no doubt. Annie Lennox, pretty much legendary. Garfield, so just back to the, I don't know, I guess how everything goes down. So when you guys get to LA or move to LA, what happens? Does the label put you up in an apartment or how does that work?
Yeah. They put us in the Oakwood apartments and it was like a 2-bedroom deal just to do the album when we first got there. And, you know, 2 people in each room, but we barely stayed in the rooms because we were always in the living room with the MPC set up and all the different things with the keyboards and fiddling around, creating tunes or bridges to this song or that song, singing that or coming up with words. It was like a thing. And then when we got tired of that, we would go to the movie at the Beverly Center or go buy some from the Gap, like a hoodie or like some little clothes for our promotional tour stuff, airplane clothes, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So it was just like we had a life. We didn't have a life during that time. It was literally like straight work. But yeah, we were in apartments, the Oakwood apartments.
Oh, that's great, man. And it's crazy, right? I mean, I know I've said it, man, but you're students at Howard. Now you're signed to a record deal. You're living in LA. And it just, right, man, it just happens. I mean, it's so cool and it's just so crazy.
Oh, yeah. It was crazy. We were living a dream. And like, I knew it was a dream while I was in it. Like, I knew, like, it was like the bonus round. I always liken it unto the bonus round of a video game. Like, if you ever play Mario Brothers or something, it's this one level where you go up and you get all the coins are just dangling there. You can hit, you have access to all of them. And then the floor drops and then you back down into the regular part of the game. But we were in the bonus area of the video game. Like, and I knew I was living through it where all the coins were accessible. Like, look at all this. Yeah. You know, so.
Yeah, man, that's absolutely fantastic. And Garfield, something else that you mentioned, man, that I wrote down that I want to circle back around to, which is really cool, is that you guys performed on Top of the Pops. Top of the Pops is huge overseas, man. You guys perform on there, and that's just really cool. First airing was 1964, got canceled in 2006. But what was that experience like, man, on being on Top of the Pops?
We were performing on there. It was a group called All That. No, what was the group? It was a singing group that was real popular, along with it was a girl. I wish I remember these names. She's still doing Kylie Minogue with somebody like that. Yeah, Kylie Minogue.
Yeah, of course.
It was a white group at the time. They were 5 guys. They had their sleeves rolled up, and they were like insanely popular over there during that time. And we were kicking it with them. I can't remember their names at all.
Yeah, I got you, man. That would be Take That.
Take That. Take That. Yeah, it was Take That. We was cool with us and Take That was kicking it, you know what I'm saying? Going around. It was just fun, awesome. Fun stuff. And they loved us. We loved their sound and stuff like that. They asked us questions. And then we were blowing up over in Europe. People loved us over there, man. It was just like, it was wild. That's what it really was. Everywhere we went.
Yeah, it's really wild, man. Very cool. Garfield, any interesting stories that you can share with the listeners from your time over in Europe?
We got to ride the Concorde. We got to do the pilot episode of the pilot, because they double booked us, right? They took us, we were either in France or Britain, but they, and it was like, not only did we do the Top of the Pops, but it was some equivalent to the Grammys over there. Like they called it something, but it was like the haughty crowd with the tuxes. And we were also in about 6 hours supposed to do what became the pilot version of the MTV Unplugged. The first episode of MTV Unplugged was Shy, Tony, and Tupac.
Wow.
And we were going to miss that. And that was going to mess our relationship up with MTV. So they had to put us on the Concorde and get us to New York in 4 hours so we can show up for that. And so we got the ride on the Concorde, which was like, oh my God, that was, we had our own, you get on the plane, they give you this leather menu with your name branded into it. You see Garfield Bright on this leather menu. And everything in that menu is you privy to. Like, you just tell the chefs what you want, and every seat is first class.
That's great.
Oh, it was just crazy. It goes up to some crazy 60,000 feet or something crazy, you know, and you can feel the torque. It was just crazy. And we literally, it was great. It was the greatest thing. And we didn't have to recoup that because it was their fault. So we got to just,
heck yeah, there you go,
ride on their dime on a Concorde before they shut them down, man. Like, a lot of people can't say they had that experience, and I'll never forget that.
Yeah, no doubt. That's awesome, man. Concorde, I believe, stopped operation around 2003, 2004. Had a top speed of around 1,300 miles per hour or something like that. Man, it's crazy. Garfield, how long were you guys over in Europe?
Man, we kept going back and forth. So intermittently, it was like the duration of that first album, we spent a lot of time, like months over there, like 2 months at a time. Like, we were always going to Europe and staying. And then going back, doing other stints with, like, you know, MTV again. They wanted us to come back and do some things. And then Top of the Pops wanted us to come back and do some things. And, you know, we were always going. And then we went all over. So, like, Greece, spent a lot of time in Britain proper, Scotland. We went everywhere, all through Europe, Paris. Just everywhere, all through Europe, just all over, you know.
Yeah, man, just another cool life experience that you got to live through. Garfield, let's get back to the story, man. Let's get back to If I Ever Fall in Love. In 1992, it reaches number two, man, on the Hot 100 chart. It is held off from the number one spot by Whitney Houston's song from the Bodyguard soundtrack, I Will Always Love You. Garfield, to this day, man, do you look back on that and go, oh my God, man, we got to number two. We were almost to number one. We didn't quite make it. Is that something that irks you to this day, or have you kind of just moved on from that?
Right. Well, I mean, well, and if you could look at it two ways, in one side of the coin, yes. But on the other side of the coin, when you look at the company at the time that was top 10 while our song was doing that, like Babyfaces and L.A. Reid's and the Boyz II Men's and all these super groups, we were higher than for a long period of time. And Whitney Houston, that Bodyguard soundtrack was like the iconic, that defined her career, you know what I mean? So out of all the hits that she had, that was the iconic memory of Whitney. So we were in big company. It was like heavyweight fight, you know? So it's like a proud of that at the same time. And I think it was maybe some record we broke, Elvis Presley or something, for being number two. But the reason we were, the only reason why we didn't hit number one, I found out, was that right when we were at number two is when the thing switched in terms of Billboard's criteria for chart positions to include video. At the time, it was just record play and sales, airplay and sales. And then right when we charted to number two, they threw in video, and Whitney Houston's song was part of a movie.
Right.
So the visual presence that she was getting because of the movie itself, and it was in the movie, was over, you know, to include that. That's what created a situation where we didn't get to be number one. And so, and we had this little cheap video that
yeah, man, you guys shot, you know, a little bit of a low budget video for that song. And that's interesting, Garfield. I never knew that the video element played a factor at that point in time. That's interesting. Garfield, as we have talked about, there's two versions to If I Ever Fall in Love, an acapella version and a music version. What version do you prefer?
Man, that's, I think we did such a good job, you know, with the music version that those two sit side by side to me, like depends on your mood. Like for people who need music, like it actually served its purpose that the label needed. Like for program directors who wanted them track, the music version, there's no fall off. For people who want that raw emotion of just vocals, the acapella version is classic. So both of them, I think, are equally classic versions. You know, I can't really slight either one.
Yeah, man, no doubt. As you guys did a fantastic job on both of them. If I had to pick my favorite, it would be very difficult for me because I really do enjoy both. Garfield, you mentioned it earlier. We talked about it briefly, and that is the next single that comes out. Here we go, man. This is where you guys start butting heads with your record label, Gasoline Alley. Tell me what the next single was to be released and what happened with the record label.
Comforter. And we had a battle with them to get Comforter to come out. They wanted to put Baby, I'm Yours out next. And it was almost like a bet that we had with the label. They wanted to kind of make us, they wanted to make us shut up and dribble, kind of like how they told LeBron to shut up and dribble. We came to the label saying, look, I know we young and all that kind of thing, but we are humans in the marketplace as products. We're human products that can hear and see and speak. And the people have let us know that they love Comforter. And the label, because of the pop elements of Baby, I'm Yours, wanted that to be second. And we knew that that was going to alienate us even further from our black radio station route. So we were like, nah, the people want Comforter next. And they were like, look, we know this industry. Y'all don't, basically. Y'all need to just shut up and dribble. It was like, nah. And they were like, you know what? We're going to show y'all. We're going to put Comforter out and let you see what happens. So basically, they put Comforter out and didn't really support it in the marketplace. They didn't put hardly any money behind it or anything. But because the Comforter people really liked that song and it still was phone call driven in terms of what they played at the radio stations, Comforter had its own traction. And it went gold without any push, which meant that if they had pushed that, it could have easily been platinum. So after the life of Comforter was over with, it was almost platinum. And then they put out Baby, I'm Yours, and it wasn't getting the same kind of traction organically as Comforter was getting. So they had to actually put money behind that a little more and pump it and pay some people and do things, you know, for it to even go gold like Comforter did. So we kind of like low-key won that bet. One, we got three singles out the album as opposed to just two, because I feel like after Baby, I'm Yours, they wouldn't have put anything else out. But because of that, they put Comforter out. And then they were going to put Baby, I'm Yours out anyway. So we got three singles to come out off that first album, which both went into the top 10.
Yeah, and at that time, man, as far as the next release went, whether it be Comforter or Baby, I'm Yours, I mean, you guys were, I mean, that wasn't like a little fun thing between you and the label, right? I mean, you guys were really butting heads, right?
We were butting heads over that. And they wanted to show us smart, alecky-ass college kids who thought they knew stuff in this industry that we didn't really know shit. So they were like, they really put it out to kind of like show us that we didn't know what we were talking about, because the analytics and where they were trying to position us radio-wise, Baby, I'm Yours was that. But Comforter really organically had traction, and we knew it, and it really did what it did. And
yeah, and it did well. In 1993, it goes to number 10 on the Hot 100 chart and number 4 on the R&B charts. Garfield, but here we go, man. You guys are with Gasoline Alley not very long at this point in time. And there it is, man. I guess right now, you guys are already butting heads over creative differences, right?
Well, yeah, in a lot of ways, because we were bullheaded college kids who, you know, kind of were like, we had our own identities and we were real like adamant about being who we were and not really just being some cookie cutter product of a label's machine, especially when we saw that they were pushing us towards a pop-esque persona, because that sold more units. We didn't want to sell out. We came from a black college. We wanted to kind of be a little bit more rooted in our black radio, and they were purposely seeming like they were going away from black radio, because the underlying kind of like thing was that black people don't really buy music like how white people buy music. So pop radio, that's where you're gonna get your record sales. Let's go the revenue route. And we were like, nah, man, people really feeling this song Comforter, and they'll buy this. Like, come on. So they kind of wanted to show us that the industry was something that they knew about and we didn't. But it
yeah, and ultimately in the end, you guys proved the label wrong. As I just said, it went to number 10 on the Hot 100 charts, number 4 on the R&B charts. Garfield, at some point in time, does Gasoline Alley circle back around to you guys and apologize?
Oh, hell no. They just get ready to put Baby I'm Yours out, and they put money behind it like it was a real major thing so they can really make it sell more units. So which worked for us too, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And, you know, they got it up to the status that they got it up to, but they had to work it harder. It wasn't getting ads and stuff like organically as Comforter was.
So before we get to Baby I'm Yours, Garfield, Comforter is released. There is basically no promotion behind that record from Gasoline Alley. Garfield, let's say there was promotion from Gasoline Alley with that record. What does that look like? What does the promotion do, and what does it look like?
Oh, wow. A bevy of things, like in terms of marketing materials. They call them POPs, like different displays in stores, reaching out to publishing to get you put in different magazine slots, Vibes, different places. Then on the video, to make a more expensive video to be serviced, that'd be more, you know, appealing. And then the radio relationships, really being more vigilant in terms of getting this song added. If it means paying the program director or coaxing them or taking them out to dinner or whatever it is, being more vigilant in that regard to get that chart, to get that ad done as a higher priority. So just put more emphasis on the priority of that song being added to these major stations who other stations copy the playlist. Just all that means that they're pushing it. And you'll see yourself in commercials putting you on Arsenio Hall or Jay Leno during the single, that life of that single puts you in visibility range so people can see, oh, they got this out now? Okay, I'm going to go get it. You know, you visit all of those, the whole package. Comforter was not getting that kind of love. But Baby I'm Yours, during that time, we were getting that.
Yeah, man, let's talk about it. Released in 1993, the third single released from If I Ever Fall in Love goes to number 10 on the Hot 100 charts, number 19 on the R&B charts. And Garfield, it is a known fact, man, that Baby I'm Yours is not one of your favorite songs.
How you know?
it's called research, man.
How you know that, man?
But yeah, Garfield, man. I love that song, man. That is probably my favorite song off of the album. And like I said, man, I just love it.
Everybody does. I swear. I can't even.
Yeah, so what's your deal with the song, man?
I don't dislike it. That's probably too harsh. I just like the version of it when it was just the piano. And we used to sing like the vocals with the piano because those chords are Marvin Gaye's Let's Get It On. That's Baby I'm Yours. The bass of that is Let's Get It On. So when we did it just with our voices and the piano, it had more soulful like resonance. It sounded more. So when we ended up having that version where it's serviceable to pop radio and it had that. When that came into it, it just kind of felt so pop to me, man. I just kind of like, I was just disappointed that that was in there, man. I was like, yo, that's messing up our song. Because I used to love Baby I'm Yours. So it was that's what it really was more than anything. Not that I hated it. I just didn't like the fact that that became the version that was the version. But everybody loved it. Everybody loved that song, man.
Yeah, and what else I love, Garfield, is the video, man. The video is fantastic. You guys get to go back to Howard to shoot the video. And Garfield, the video is great, man. There's an innocence to it. There's a boy meets girl vibe to it. And I don't know, man. It's great. I hate to use this word to describe it as a guy, but it's just, it's cute, man. I mean, it's just a sweet, cute video. That's what it is.
It was. And one sub story, Mark Gay in that video of the group, the girl that was his love interest, they re-met like 30 years later and they're actually married now, have a kid.
Wow.
It's wild. And it's crazy that that happened. Like that's such a, you can't write anything better than that.
Oh
like,
man, that's great.
So I love that. And we didn't pick like for that video, because we were going back to Howard to do the video, we didn't look at any Z cards for models or anything in advance. We got to Howard and literally canvassed the campus and asked girls, would they be down to be in our video? Because we picked, like I said, if you go back to the beginning of this interview, Howard women were so beautiful. Why would we pick some other models to be in the video that we were shooting at Howard when we can just really just get the organic Howard women who were down to be in the video? And Ananda, who had her own fame, she was in the video. You know, it was a lot of cool stuff about that video, man. It was the singing in the bleachers at the end where we doing a cappella. We literally would do that kind of stuff for real at Howard. Like, you know, after our rehearsals, we'd go sit down somewhere and just sing a little a cappella stuff. So it captured a lot of our real organic way of being, as well as the Howard. It was a big PR campaign for, yo, come to Howard if you want to come to HBCU. It was like a commercial too at the same time. And that was our way of giving back, you know.
Yeah, that's fantastic, man. And really cool that that was your way of giving back to Howard University. Garfield, you mentioned Ananda. Ananda would be Ananda Lewis, Howard University graduate, went on to have success in the late 90s as an MTV VJ. Garfield, what was your take, or what is your take on the video?
Oh, I loved it, man. It, like, me and Darnell got to play out a scene in our, in a dorm room, and that really was like how, like, we were roommates. We were sitting in a Howard cafeteria, flicking food back and forth, like stuff that really, it was just really true to form. And we had a lot of sway in terms of like video direction, even though the director directed it. He took input from us in terms of how to make it as organic as, you know, we were, you know, as organic as possible based on what we really saw and what we really did. So he made that happen. And so, yeah, I love that video, man. It was a true to, it was a true to heart video.
Yeah, that's really cool, man. And it shows, because it looks like you guys are just having a good time and everything looks natural. Garfield, who played your love interest in the video?
It was a female named Kenya. And she was my love interest, and she was dope. You know, she ended up working in the industry for a little while and stuff like that. And so did Darnell's love interest, Joy. She was like an executive at Capitol Records and stuff like that. You know, she's still in the industry. Yeah, it's like those people end up, they were really something and stuff, like outside of just being in Shah's video. So, and Ananda, of course, and Mark's girl was his wife, future wife, and he had no idea that was going to be his future wife. Like, that's crazy to me.
I know, man. That's so wild.
Yo.
Crazy. Garfield, how long did that video take to shoot?
Most of our videos took like 2 days, except for Come With Me was the most elaborate. We did that at two locations off the second album. But that took about 2 days to do. You know, you get up at 6 a.m. and you filming all the way to like 10:30 at night, 11 at night, and you do it again the next morning. But that one wasn't as long as a lot of the videos, now that I think about it.
As we said, great song and a great video as well. Garfield, there it is, man. We pretty much discussed all three singles that were released. If I Ever Fall in Love, Comforter, and Baby I'm Yours. Now, Together Forever, which is a fan favorite as well. I don't believe, or maybe it was released as a single by the label. Do you remember?
Yeah, I think it ended up getting chart, some kind of low chart position, but I don't think they actually tried to release it. I think that that was actually an organic, like, people loved it off the album, and some program directors just decided to start playing that off the album.
I gotcha. So yeah, and you're right about that. It did. It charted at number 89 on the R&B charts. But you're basically saying that the reason for it charting was because program directors at radio stations just decided to play it, and because they decided to play it, it charted.
Yeah, I don't think that they actually released it.
Gotcha. I'm surprised, man. They should have.
Yeah, y'all should have. Like, y'all should have released this as a single. I'm gonna play this on my show. Or I'm gonna play this on my show. You know, you gotta. Or, I mean, most of our stuff was organic like that. That's Shy kind of was in that niche of that. Like,
yeah, and I tell you what, man, and you can speak to it, Garfield. That is a beautiful song.
And that's, look, Mark wrote that while he was in high school, before Shy was even thought of. Mark, at his high school in Miami, he wrote that and arranged it, and he brought that wholesale to the group. You know, usually the group collaborates on songs, but that one, Mark was like, look, I have a song that I would like for us to sing. And Darnell, I want you to sing this lead with me. And that's, in our shows, a baby grand piano would just come up from the bottom of the stage and just emerge. And then Mark would come out and sit there. And our band would take a step back and be like, and Darnell would say, ladies and gentlemen, Mark Gay. And then he'll start on the piano. And then Darnell would come in, and then me and Carl would just be back there singing the hook and the harmonies and everything. And that was like, that was a beautiful song, man. He wrote a hell of a song.
Man, that song to me is almost like a Tender Love by the Foursome D's.
Oh yeah, I agree. That's a great analogy. Like, yeah, that's definitely like a Tender Love. Yes, exactly. Like, it's just a beautiful song. No matter, like, it's just one of them songs that transcend color, like in both markets just would embrace it. It was just a pretty song, you know what I'm saying? So.
Yeah, man, absolutely. Should have been released as a single. Garfield, the last song that I want to talk about off of the If I Ever Fall in Love album would be Waiting for the Day. Another one of my favorite songs off of that album. Fantastic song, man. Wanted to ask you, who does the rap part on that song?
Oh my God. Damn, waiting for the day.
This is going to sound really bad, but whatever. Divine, talk to him, man. Yo, I'm so excited because I know I'm in love and it's a special kind of feeling. I just can't get enough. That part.
Oh, that's Carl. That's Carl right there. That's Carl right there. Yeah.
Okay. That's Carl. Yeah. He did a good job.
Yeah, he did. He did do a good job. Carl can write. He was a great writer.
Yeah, man. Very well done for sure. Garfield, this is the question that I've probably been most excited to ask you. 1987, 1988, 1989, obviously there's R&B music around at that point in time. You have, New Edition is out there, Troop is out there, Guy is out there, along with many others. But I tell you what, man, 1991, 1992 rolls around, and there is just kind of like this explosion of groups, H-Town, Silk, You Guys, Intro, Tevin Campbell, Color Me Bad. I mentioned a lot of them at the top of the podcast. I wanted to ask you, man, and get your thoughts on this. How does that happen? And what was it like to be part of that scene?
It was a enchanted period for hip hop and R&B. I think coming out of because it was a renaissance of like music going into a direction coming out of the 80s with the synthesized music. There was like this wanting to come back to this feel of organic like sound. So people, it was an amalgam of some of the 70s soul and the synthesized stuff coming together through these young people who were exposed to like a young Teddy Riley who was coming, who was a young guy, but also coming out of the hip hop world of hip hop being like a art form coming from the margins where people were expressing themselves in ways. You had singers within hip hop like MC, TJ Swan, like Nobody Beats the Biz, and you got Full Force producing Lisa, and then you got UTFO who also could sing. Like little remnants of that was part of our childhood, even through the hip hop stage. So now we're in college, and you got movies like Lean on Me with Riff singing in the bathroom, doing an acapella Fair East Side. You got a youth culture now coming into existence, where it used to just be listening to your parents' music because of hip hop. Now you got people who actually are looking for how to express music through a youth scenario. And High Five was early on getting commercials with Sprite and stuff like that. And then Boyz II Men with the Coolie Eye Harmony kind of in Jodeci for the Renaissance part of it for the 90s kind of kicked off this dynamic where harmonies were part of it, but also this blend of hip hopness with the look with Puffy kind of like styling. Jodeci, all of those dynamics, and Puffy coming from Howard, busting into the scene, influencing the scene with his fingerprint, and us also coming from Howard, we were kind of part of that pulse. And everybody seemed to have a one of one, but everybody was also trying to express this new amalgamation of soul and harmonies and hip-hopness in this hip kind of way. And it looked different on different people, but it came out as Silk when it came to Silk. It came out as a Jodeci. It came out as a UNV from Detroit. It came out as a Shy who met at Howard and H-Town from Houston. One of our first shows, it was H-Town, Silk, and Shy in Florida in some hole in the wall. And that before any tours, we performed together and we was like a competition, but a friendly competition. But that's when you start seeing elements of this new, you know, which way are we going to take R&B type of thing. Jodeci and Boyz II Men were polarized, so they represented a polar sound. Like Jodeci was way on the other side of Boyz II Men, but then you had groups kind of in between, like an Intro and Shy and the Silks, kind of representing different offshoots of that sound. And New Edition was the godfathers of us all, because they were like little young men when we were young men, but they were also in the industry with grown men. So by the time we got to be in the industry, they had already been veterans in the game. So that sound, though, coming up, listening to how young people sing, you know, certain harmonies and different things, Mr. Telephone Man and all the different stuff that New Edition was bringing to the table, we kind of had that in our DNA, too, how to flip that different. And then gospel groups like Commission had an influence on the R&B scene with their harmonies and stuff like that. Take Six. So all of those different sounds permeated the space, and people were just snatching and grabbing different elements to funnel it through their understanding of what was dope. given those elements. And you started seeing these real one-of-one type of iterations pop up that were real quality from girls and guys. Mint Condition, coming from that Minneapolis sound, playing all the instruments themselves with Stokely, who was really a dope drummer, also being a lead front man, can sing his butt off and write. All these new phenomena coming out. It was real performative. Movies like Purple Rain set the precedent for like this performative kind of piece, Beat Street for hip hop. And, you know, people were like, and then you still had like Public Enemy, people who were being outspoken and out front. All of these elements were like creating young artists and the temperament for young artists to be in front. And so it was just a unique, magical time period in terms of like performative culture and youth culture overlapping at the same time. The arts was real big in that moment. And then across collaborative pieces like hip hop's inception with Blondie, her, the punk scene kind of embracing the hip hop. Like, so it was like rock music wasn't really strangers. So you had certain people who, you got a one side of R&B all the way to the other side with more rock tones, all the way to gospel tones and jazz and everything in between being represented at once, you know, and running concurrently alongside of hip hop, like also influenced people with the look of D'Angelo, with the look of Jaheim, but with the sound of these incredible musicians and singers. So it was all fusing and it was like, so the hip hop swag and the R&B presence and talent was there. Like Boyz II Men with the big coats, the Shearlings, influenced by Michael Bivins, who was, you know, an OG from New Edition, but also on the pulse in terms of trends, and all of that was going on. And you got the LaFace, the independent record movement, with Jermaine Dupri, a young Criss Cross, and all these people coming up, the Brat coming up from this TLC, Dallas Austin, getting their legs up under them through that subculture and showing themselves to be worthy musicians and artists and trendsetters in their own right with the eye patch. And it was just a real trend setting time. And then Puffy coming into the game, setting all these different trends with R&B and hip hop. It was just a, you know, smorgasbord of just trendy staying power type of classic stuff that was going on with real quality pulls from different influences that was showing up through our bodies and our voices. So
very cool, man. And I appreciate that lesson. That's a fantastic answer, man. Garfield, one more thing, man, then I'm going to let you get out of here. Just really quickly, I guess I'll try to do it quickly. Want to name a couple of bands, couple of groups, couple of artists, and I'd like to get your thoughts on what you think of them. And sure. Let me know too if you've ever met any of the people that I've mentioned.
Okay.
All right, here we go. PM Dawn.
Oh, wow. Well, you know, PM Dawn used to get a lot of flack because they was controversial with what they said, but they were really before their time. Like, they should have been in this time period. And because they was being called hip hop. And like people like KRS-One had a beef with that. But them songs, I love PM Dawn's music, man. Like, Songs Without You. Like, they had this dope melodic fusion of some elements that was different, you know, like the same, it fit perfectly with I Wanna Sex with my boys, Color Me Bad and PM Dawn. They melodically had similar things going on. It was a different iteration of it. But I actually liked the two singles that PM Dawn had that was real popular. That Life Without You, A Loss Without You, whatever that was. And then the other one, it was more like a poem kind of thing he was kicking.
I Die Without You and Set Adrift on Memory Bliss.
Yeah. That was, I can't front. I love that music. That was dope to me. So, you know, but they were, as people, they were kind of caught in just the cross wave of them breaking into some new genre that was being labeled hip hop by the mainstream and the hip hop heads. Like, that ain't hip hop, you know what I mean? And they kind of caught a bad one for standing up for themselves. And then they kind of like went too far with it, trying to diss some hip hop dudes. But musically, I dug PM Dawn's sound. I can't even lie. I like that sound.
Yeah, man, me too. Ever meet those guys?
No, I never met those dudes. I never met those dudes. I just saw them on videos and just like listened to their music and like their music.
How about Ready for the World?
Oh, come on. I love Ready for the World. Like, and I was cool with Melvin. Melvin Riley from Ready for the World, he was on MCA. And so, like, but growing up before I ever met him, you know, when I was at Howard, I used to sing Ready for the World songs and shit. That, you know, Let Me Love You Down, Oh Sheila, you know what I'm saying? That was like you get game from that. Like, you know what I mean?
Right.
You sing it.
Yeah,
to
no
it.
Doubt.
Never really mattered too much to me. You know what I'm saying? You see, if girls heard you singing that, they'd be like, ooh, you can sing. I dug at RFTW, man. They was definitely one of my favorites, for real.
Yeah, man.
Ready for the World. Melvin Riley, big ups, props. Love that guy.
Yeah, and don't forget about Slide Over, man. That's a classic slow jam.
Yo, Slide Over. I forgot about Slide Over.
Yeah, man. I might be only 19, yeah, but baby, you can still grab a hole. That's great, man. I sound terrible, but that's great. Garfield, what about Snow?
Oh, Snow with the rap dude Snow. Right?
Informer.
Oh, Informer. Informer, that was Informer, man. That he paved the way from Eminem to me. Snow came out of nowhere, and that Informer joint blew up. I catch your boom boom, yeah, all that, whatever you were saying. I never knew how he was saying it, but he was killing that. Informer was a big hit, and I can't think of nobody who could say that they ain't like that joint.
Yeah, man, great song. And MC Shan was on that track too.
Oh, MC Shan was on. That's yeah, crazy. Man, MC Shan, what? That's wild. Juice Crew all day.
Ever meet him?
Never met Snow. I just love that song. That song was like always on the charts too. I used to always see that song. Yep. But he killed that song. He killed that.
Yeah, man, he really did. And that song was enormous overseas, man. And it did well in America, went to number one on the Hot 100 charts. And I believe somewhere around number 12 or 14 on the top 40 charts. But Garfield, the greatest thing about that song is the title of the album that it comes off of. Do you know the name of that album?
What was it?
So great. 12 Inches of Snow.
Oh, damn. I never knew.
So great, man.
I never knew that, man. Yeah, man. I just knew that song Informer was crazy. And matter of fact, I didn't know it was white dude when I first heard that. Like, I just heard that song. And that song, come on, everybody get up and start, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Start jamming, you know. Informer. Da, 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 you know.
Get your I look your boom, yeah. Boom down.
Killing that. That little quick throat.
No doubt.
Yeah, he was killing that. But he had soul too, though. He had swag.
Yeah, man, no doubt. And hard to believe that's coming from a white guy. Garfield, here we go. Next one. The Boys.
Oh, everybody love The Boys, man. Like The Boys, the Hakeem and all them. And not only for their music, and they were so talented as little young dudes. Like, they was playing instruments and they moved to Ghana and everything. Like, that also was like, wow, yo, these dudes are different, man. And they never like went back on their Muslim, like, you know, they stay true to their Muslim religion. And I admired The Boys as little boys. Like, I thought that they was, whoever raised them did a hell of a job. Like, they stood on their firm on who they were. They were themselves, but they just happened to be talented as hell. And they didn't let the industry dictate their being. Like, I love that.
Yeah, man. Dial My Heart, classic track.
Oh, Dial My Heart, man. But it was other stuff that they did. And then one of the dudes was end up being a filmmaker, I think, or something like that. Like, I used to like really like follow what happened to them guys, because one of them, I think, either
Kyrie, yep,
became a film guy. Like, you know, I'm impressed by those guys. I wish I could have met them. I never met those dudes, but I always wanted to kind of chop it up with them dudes, man. I feel like some ideas could have been exchanged there.
Yeah, man. All right, here we go, Garfield. For some D's.
Legend, 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 legends, and like. Because they was the Force MCs before they was the Force MDs. They was rapping first, itching for a scratch. And then they came out with Forgive Me, Girl. And then from Forgive Me, Girl, people knew they could sing. And then they came out with Tears? What? Are you kidding me? Some dudes that was rapping could sing like that? Stop playing, man. And Tender Love and all. Yo, there will never be another Force MDs. Those dudes were off the chain. Incredible.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one, man. I've always liked the Foursome D's. All right, here we go, Garfield. Lenny Williams.
Oh. That dude?
Yep, that's it, man. That dude.
I love you. Oh, come on, legend.
Yeah, man.
Legend.
Yeah.
Legend. My mom loved Lenny Williams.
Yeah, man. How great is that dude?
Yeah, that dude. Come on, man. Lenny Williams, man.
Classic.
Showman. Extraordinaire, bro. Like, that's all I can say.
Ever meet him?
I never met Lenny Williams. I wish I had him. I met a lot of old heads like around his time period, like Gerald Austin from the Manhattans and my man from the Stylistics, Russell, and you know. But I never got to meet Lenny Williams, man. I wish I had him, because I can imagine he was probably colorful like that in person. You know what I mean?
Yeah, man, I'm sure you're right. All right, Garfield, here we go. I was a big fan back in the day. My boy Bryce, well, not really my boy. I don't even know him, but a lot of respect for Bryce. Songwriter, producer, actor. I was a big fan, Garfield, of Groove Theory.
Oh, Mel and Bryce. Mel is another one who I respect tremendously. I respect Bryce too. Crazy producer, just dope. But Mel, man, being as beautiful as she is, she never like forsook, if that's a word, her identity as a Muslim or a Muslim woman. Like she never really sought the out front fame and being in people's faces and all that, even though she had all the beauty in the world that would have just wowed everybody. She just really wanted to sing her songs, but she made some incredible songs, man. Like she got like a real deep layers to her. And I respect the hell out of Mel LaRue. And but Groove Theory too. I've been doing my own thing. You know what I'm saying? Bryce as a producer. Groove Theory was definitely part of my soundtrack for sure.
Have you ever met Bryce or Mel?
I met Bryce on a couple occasions, you know what I mean? But I never got to meet a Mel. I never met a Mel. She was never like in front. Like she was never like going to no industry functions and none of that stuff. I think she had a husband at the time. She wasn't trying to be all out there hobnobbing and all. She wanted to make her music. She didn't even really want to go on tour on things, stuff like that. She just wanted to do what her soul was made to do in her own mind, like just pursue some pretty music, inspire some people. But she didn't want all the Hollywood show businessy aspect, all that. She didn't want none of that. You know what I mean? She didn't want that superficial. She didn't want to be seen in a superficial light. Like she was more than that. And I could tell. So I got a lot of respect for that woman. She's one of the dopest women in the industry.
Yeah, man, for sure. And Tell Me was obviously their big song and absolutely fantastic. All right, Garfield, here we go, man. Just a couple of more, man. Then I am going to let you get out of here, let you get some plugs out, give me some final thoughts. But let's get to these two last ones. Here we go. 4x4.
4x4? I'm not really familiar with 4x4 like that.
Oh, man.
I'm not really familiar. What songs?
Yeah, man, they're kind of like one of those lost 80s hidden gems that a whole lot of people don't know about. Come Over was their big song.
Come Over.
Yeah, that's it. That's it right there.
Yeah, I do know that song. Is that a female group?
No, man, those are guys.
I know that song for some reason.
Yeah, you probably know it because it was written by Melvin Riley. And the song, man, I tell you, it sounds just like Ready for the World.
Oh, that's probably why I know the song, because I'm a Melvin fan. Like anything sounded like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe that's probably why. I probably thought it was Ready for the World all this time.
Yeah, for sure. Like I said, man, it sounds just like them. All right, here we go. Last one for you, Garfield. Here we go. 3T.
Oh, wow. I forgot about 3T. I don't remember their music, though, but I remember the marketing, 3T. I can't remember what they sung.
Oh, geez, man, you're killing me. All right, here we go. I'll do it again. It's going to sound awful, but whatever. Their big song was Anything. Sitting at home, another lonely night. Wish you were here so I could hold you tight. Vision, that song.
Oh, yeah. I dug them, man. They had a couple of dope jingles. They had a couple of dope songs.
They did. Tease Me was a song by those guys that was pretty popular. They also did a song with their uncle, Michael Jackson, called Why. That was popular. And they are Tito Jackson's sons, Garfield.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's the angle. Yes. That's right. That's cool, man.
Yeah, man. And that is pretty cool, actually. And those guys were good, man. I like 3T. Those guys could sing. All right, Garfield, let's go ahead and get to some plugs, man. Anything out there that you would like to mention and that you would like to plug?
Man, like my book I told you about, Lotus 3013, A Hip-Hop Thought Experiment. It's a combination of Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, and Beat Street. It's coming out towards the end of March. So be looking at my IG, which is the Garfield Bright Experience. For further details, I'm going to start putting out trailers next week. And, you know, support me. It's going to be $20 for the audiobook as well, along with the ebook. It's paperless. So you can read along with the audiobook. And my twin sons, who are Grammy nominated for doing work with like Post Malone, they play the score underneath me reading. And Darnell has given me the track Destiny to interweave through it. So be looking for that. Tune in to my Curiosity Collage on the same platform. It comes out every Monday at 8:00 p.m. Central Time. And some new music after those projects are finished. We have some music on the shelf that we're planning to put out. I'm exploring this NFT world, it's non-fungible tokens, which is a hell of a new space of creativity for creatives. So I'm looking to put some music and some art, digital art and stuff like that in that space, the metaverse worlds and everything. So look for me in that world as well. And if you don't know about NFTs, read up on the NFT Bible, get it off of Google and just check it out. It's a hell of a space for creatives to put their work and get their due compensation in perpetuity. And the world is so malleable. There's no gatekeepers right now. And you can pretty much just check it out. It's an unbelievable kind of thing that's available to artists right now.
That's really cool. I'll have to check it out. I'm not familiar with it, but I'll definitely check it out. Garfield, is there anywhere fans can get Shy merchandise?
We're working on that as we speak, Darnell and myself. We don't have anything new because the label, we did a deal way back with Winterland, but now we're creating merch. We're designing merch as we speak to put out on our platform. So that's coming by summertime. We should have some stuff on the Shy platform with the Shyroglyphics on Facebook and Instagram. S-H-A-I, Roglyphics. And but we'll have, you know, different types of merch, different, we're working on different things like other than shirts, different trinkets, different things that mean things to people that are nostalgic, that people can use in their daily activities with our logos and stuff on them.
Yeah, cool, man. There you go. I like it. Just to recap, make sure you check out Shy's Instagram page. It is Shyloglyphics. Make sure you check out Garfield's personal Instagram page, the Garfield Bright Experience. When you're there, make sure you check out Curiosity Collage that Garfield puts out. It is very cool and very educational. Make sure you keep an eye out for his book that is coming soon, Lotus 3013. There's also new music that's coming out, and by the summer there should be Shy merchandise. Wow, I like it, man. That's a lot. Garfield, last question, man. It just popped in my mind. From your genre, 91, 92, 93, where would you rank Shy?
That's a good question, man. We were unique, we were self-contained, and because of those factors and the fact that we definitely had an impact, we didn't have a long shelf life, but the music that we did put out that became singles impacted people. Like if you look at high impact, we had high impact singles and they became classics. And so because of that factor, I could comfortably put us up there with some of the people who did have longer shelf lives who were seen in that same light. I think we were unique in that way. And so, we definitely have our own little lane and our own little niche, and we did everything our way. So I put us up there with the heavy hitters. You know, people remember, you remember Shy's music, you know, at least the singles that they, you know, they end up loving, you know, like The Comforters, The Baby I'm Yours, and If I Ever's. You know, at least those three songs hit people in such a way that we have been able to live and eat off of that. So, and it was done by some college students, man, with something to say. And so, you know, up there with the Baby Faces and the L.A. Reeds, we kind of made that same impact. So I put us up there pretty high. American Idol used to always tell us that If I Ever was the number one sang song for auditions and stuff like that. And so, you know, we messed around and got a classic. If you look at YouTube, we got like 80 million, 90 million views and stuff on that one single alone. So, you know, I put us up there with the rest of the people, pretty much of our genre, during that time, that were hard hitters.
Agree, man. No doubt. You guys definitely did it. All right, Garfield, man, we are done. One last thing, man. When we did our pre-interview, you were telling me that, which is very cool, man. It's a small world that Darnell lives here. Another member of the group, Shy, obviously, and that you frequently come to Charlotte. So, dude, when you come to Charlotte, man, because I'm in Charlotte. We got to hang, man.
Oh, there's no question. There's no question.
Cool.
There's no question.
Hey, I'm looking forward to that, man.
When I come to Charlotte, because I'm definitely coming to Charlotte because Darnell is out there. Next time I come to Charlotte, I'm gonna hit you up and have you meet me wherever, you know, where we can have a meeting spot. And we just gonna chill, man, you know.
Yeah, I like it, man. Looking forward to it. And I'll take you to get some food, Garfield. But I do realize, man, that because you're a vegan, I'm probably going to have to find a vegan restaurant. But not a problem, man. I know there's plenty of them here in Charlotte.
Oh, I'm used to not having vegan options. So I'll create my little options. You know, I just make sure it don't have no salt hardly in it. And just the basics, you know, just some damn carrots and some lettuce.
Feel you, man.
Nah, man. As long as they got just straight raw food, I can get with that, man. Yeah.
That's great. Hey, Garfield, you are done, man. I really do appreciate you taking time out of your day to come on the podcast and talk to me and to share all your stories. They were absolutely fantastic. Once again, man, thank you very much. And I do look forward to hanging out with you the next time you're here in Charlotte.
Hey, man, I really enjoyed myself. This was a blast. We talked about some things I hadn't uncovered in years, and I'm glad that we had this opportunity to really chop it up.
Yeah, man, me as well. Definitely good times. It was educational, and I learned a lot. So once again, thank you, Garfield. Guys, don't forget, if you would like to show your love and your support to this podcast, you can now do so through a PayPal donation. Donate $100 to receive some very fly, cool, dope Being Famous podcast swag, or you can also donate any dollar amount that you desire. For more information, head over to my webpage, beingfamouspodcast.com. That's beingfamouspodcast.com. Show your love, show your support, and make a donation to this podcast. Hope everybody enjoyed my conversation with Garfield Bright. I will talk to you guys on the next episode. Peace.